Welcome to Protected, Adolescence and Contraception, a Team PEDS Talks podcast series brought to you by the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners. Access to contraception and reproductive care is an essential aspect of adolescent-friendly healthcare services and to preventing teen pregnancy, sexually transmitted infections, and more. Yet many teens face significant barriers. This podcast series is a call to action for pediatric-focused clinicians who can contribute significantly to increasing access for this important aspect of adolescent healthcare. The focus of this series is to address multiple aspects of contraceptive care, from confidentiality to various available methods, and to provide clinical pearls to help improve access for adolescents regardless of setting. Each guest is most knowledgeable about the laws and policies of their own state and has brought this viewpoint into their conversation. It is important to maintain knowledge of your own local, state, and federal laws that relate to the provision of reproductive health services for adolescents. My name is Allison Moriarty-Daly. I am an adolescent clinician and have spent nearly 30 years providing reproductive care to teens within primary care settings and educating nurse practitioner students to care for this population. The idea for this podcast series came from recent work on a collaborative project for NAPNAP that addressed reproductive access for adolescents. We felt that this series could help provide education to other nurse practitioners to help remove existing barriers and improve clinical care in this area. I have had the pleasure of speaking to many adolescent experts on a wide variety of topics. I hope you enjoy this series, and I welcome you to contact me with additional ideas for future episodes. This has been an exciting journey. Let's talk about it. So today's episode is focused on contraceptive access for male adolescents. Thank you so much for joining me today, Chris. Dr. Chris Gentry is a pediatric nurse practitioner who has practiced in federally qualified health centers and school-based clinics in both New Haven, Connecticut and Los Angeles, California. His clinical focus is providing full scope primary care with an attention on sexually transmitted infections, diagnosis and treatment, and sexual health counseling. He currently splits his time seeing patients and as the director of clinical operations. He is planning a robust transitions clinic for teens aging out of pediatric care and entering adulthood. Let's get right into it. Can you share with our audience a little bit about your clinical practice and why contraceptive access for males is important to you?
Yeah. So thanks for having me. Thanks for asking me on this podcast. So I graduated YSN in 2013, and I started practicing out in New Haven, Connecticut, Fairhaven Community Health Center. And then my family and I moved up to California. In New Haven, I focused primarily on pediatrics, primary care, which was obviously the mix of newborn to 21-ish. Moved over to, in New Haven, I did run a school-based health center one day a week at an alternative school. So this was a school that was for teens who had socially graduated. A lot of them were reading at kindergarten or first grade level, or it was their next stop before they were, institutionalized in other places due to other sort of other activities that put them at risk, we can say. So I did that one day a week and focused heavily on STDs, contraception. Had a microscope so I could do wet mounts and things like that right there in the visit. I also did some training with the Sylvie Rattel CDC training guide program up in Hartford, Connecticut. So that was really interesting in really getting good at wet mounts and learning communication and seeing how that's done in an exclusively STD-based environment. Loved my time in Connecticut. We moved over to LA to be more closer to family. And I started work at another federally qualified health center, which is my experience is federally qualified health centers in downtown Los Angeles. And that's been sort of where I've been for a while. I was splitting my time for the last 7 years between that and teaching. And so I would teach sort of how to do a history, how to do a physical, really kind of digging into the art and science of the physical exam, and focusing a lot on on really kind of gathering a good history, and how do you talk to patients, and what should you say to patients, and how should you really build that visit and build the relationships. And then I embarked on my doctoral program, my DNP, which I did through Cal State Fullerton, which was a fantastic program. I just finished that last year. So I have you to thank for that, for the reference. Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And so now I've actually left academia, and I've now moved full-time into my clinical practice, which is 50% seeing patients. And then 50% of the time, I am the director of clinical operations at the clinic, for the entire clinic, not just for pediatrics, but for adult women's health and all the different sites we have. Yeah, it's a large FQHC. We have over a dozen clinical sites, a mix of school-based centers, large facilities. We have dental, psych, the whole kind of, we have a whole women's health midwifery kind of department, and we have a residency program. And yeah, it's sort of a nice busy mix of seeing patients and trying to make some improvements in the way in which we do see patients and the way in which we can deliver good quality care to patients who really need it. So that's kind of my nutshell, I think.
That's great. That's really great. So today we're focusing a little bit more on contraceptive access for male adolescents. And I wondered if you could kind of share what your experience has been like with that over the years at these different clinical sites.
Yeah, it's, like I said, I think prior to doing my rotations with you when I was in grad school, I was a little hesitant to really talk to teenagers. But my approach generally is one of openness. And I think that's key with teenagers. I think one of the things that we need to consider with teenagers is that they're a sort of a fickle bunch at baseline, and the smallest thing could turn them off. As you start to engage in a relationship with a teenager and you're starting to advocate for their clinical needs, if you kind of look at them in a funny way, or if there's an air of judgment, it can really sway the way in which they're going to communicate to you. So I've found that my initial approach is just to be open and frank. Understand that I'm a middle-aged man. I'm not going to try and play young. I'm not going to try and be hip and cool. I'm just going to authentically talk to my teenagers, and let them know that I actually care about what happens to them. And that is part of kind of them understanding that this doesn't have to be a one-way street, that this is actually, I've got information I can share, and I've got resources that I can share. And, how do we crack the nut, I think, is the initial thing. And I found that open, frank conversation is really a great way to start that. But my typical visit with a teenager, a male teenager, or any teenager, but for this purpose, this conversation is a male teenager, is I always start with the confidentiality agreement. And I will talk about the confidentiality agreement. I'll talk about it with both the parent and I'll talk about it with the teenager. So I'll kind of loosely talk about this with the parent there. And I'll say, look, at some point in this visit, I'm going to kick you out. And, I'm going to want to talk to your child alone. And sometimes the parents will give you this kind of like, wait a minute. But I think once I explain, well, listen, there are some things that I need to ask that they're not going to answer in front of you. That, this is not about me trying to take your child into a room and talk about all these secret, sordid things. This is about empowering your child to have a conversation with a healthcare provider as they transition into adulthood. And I often talk about, in a few years' time, they're going to be 18, and you're not going to want to hold their hand, and you're not going to want to make their appointments. You're not going to want to, call the clinic. And so it's important that they know how to talk to me and they can understand that there is actually a safe space here for them. So I usually start with that. And then once I get into the physical exam, I have a pretty routine spiel that I go over, the three steps of the confidentiality agreement, right? I'm not going to share with anybody unless I feel like you're going to hurt yourself, you're going to hurt someone else, or somebody's hurting you. And so I do go over that in quite a lot of detail. And I always bring in with me, for a female patient, I do always bring a chaperone. For male patients, I offer a chaperone, but being a male provider, oftentimes, because most of my medical assistants are females, they actually refuse that. They do not want a chaperone many times. in my subjective history of the patient, I will always do a HEDS assessment. And so I use the sort of the sexuality component of that to start to ask about sexuality awareness. You know, do you identify as male, female, somewhere in between? You know, let's talk about that. And once they have identified, if they feel comfortable to do so, then I'll sort of start to talk with them about, you know, what kind of people do you have sex with? Or are you sexually active? I think is the first question, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've learned over the years with adolescent, especially adolescent males, it seems, is that you'll say, you know, are you currently having sex? And I'll do a look around and they'll go, no. And so, okay, wait. Rephrase that. Are you having sex with anybody? Have you had sex with anybody in the last 3 months? And then
which is a very important, which is a really important distinction, right?
It really is.
What their time frame is really important. Like they may not currently be in a relationship or with someone or talking to someone, right? But you have to kind of give them some parameters around that. So that's a great point.
Yeah, there's a very literal sense about teenagers. Well, not right now, obviously. But then I will, you know, have you ever had sex, right? And so that sort of starts the conversation of then saying, well, okay, well, what do I mean by sex? Mm-hmm. What am I talking about here? And then that's usually when especially males seem to be very coy about this. They, well, you know, and so I'm very, very direct. I'll say, you know, I'm really talking about penis to vagina, penis to anus, penis to mouth, mouth to vagina, right? I'm very, you know, concrete about what I mean by those. And you can almost see when you go over that in a very open, literal way that they kind of go, oh, he doesn't really mind talking about these things. Mm-hmm. So once I've gone through sort of sexuality awareness and then sexual activity, I go over consent. Mm-hmm. And consent kind of bleeds out of sexual activity. Because I always ask about, are you feeling pressured to, you know, to have sex with anybody or to do anything that you don't want to do? Do you understand what consent is? And when I'm talking to females, I'm talking about that from, are you consenting to this? When I'm talking to males, I'm also talking about that, but I'm also inching into this idea of, do you understand when somebody says yes or no, what that means with regards to consent? So I have that discussion with them. And I think especially in today's world, probably forever really, but in the dynamics that we sort of see socially, I do spend quite a lot of time with my male patients talking about, you know, consent and that, you know, just, you know, the absence of no or the absence of yes, right, doesn't necessarily mean that you've given or not given, or somebody has given or not given consent, that needs to be reviewed at every engagement, every encounter. And then I go through resources. Things like scarlatine.com, Planned Parenthood, I offer those sorts of resources. And then I go over STI testing, what that looks like. I typically start at somewhere about 12. And I try and normalize this purely from the standpoint of, I want them to think about this like a dentist visit, right? I want them to think about this. They may not be sexually active right now, but if we do some testing now, and you know that you have negative for gonorrhea, chlamydia, et cetera, that allows you to have a conversation with your partner about you were tested for STIs and have you talked to your partner about this? And so I'm constantly looking for those avenues to expand and kind of expand on those conversations about how do you do this for yourself, but then how do you engage with your partner and how do you talk to your partner about the fact that you just got STD tested and what does that mean for you in your relationship? Another thing that I mention with all of my team patients is I always want to get a private number. So that's going to go into their medical record. So that's a confidential number that I can then, if I have a positive STD or if they have a question or if I have something I want to talk to them about in follow-up, then I can call them and not have to call the parent. So that's sort of my general kind of big picture, 10,000 feet view of my team visit.
That's great. So can you talk a little bit more about what do you include as far as counseling for teenagers to be safer? So, and how they can access, you know, contraception in general or condoms and or condoms?
Yeah, I hold my schedule. I hold a special place in my schedule for teens. I think it's such an important to think about access and how do we get teens into the visits. But the visit itself is fairly short, right? On an average visit, now in our clinic, we allot about 40 minutes, which seems like a long time, but actually the reality of it isn't. And so I try and provide as much as I can. I will pull up resources onto the computer screen that I've got in the room. I will, you know, brown bag condoms, try and slip in a little bit of information into that bag and say, look, this is for you. If you're not sexually active, here's a bag of condoms anyway. Know how they work, right? Go home, play with them, see what they do, right?
Try them on.
try them on, right? In the same way that I talk to my female patients about, you know, look, understand your period. This is a route for empowerment. This is, you know, we know that when females are more in tune with their body, they tend to make better decisions about, you know, sexual activity. And so I try and have that slant with males as well. And so condoms is a great way to kind of start that counseling. But I also tell my patients that, look, we have a limited time in this visit. So if you have had sex with somebody and you go, whoopsies, the condom broke, whoopsies, you know, I've got some discharge or I've got pain, or come in. I will see you with an unscheduled encounter. You can come in. My lunch break is your lunch break, right? So I'm really trying to open up that access so that with the understanding that the counseling in the visit is very, very quick, right? It's here's some things, here we go, here's your bag, off we go. I got to see my other three patients that are waiting. But a lot of my counseling does focus on in the visit, here's my spiel, confidentiality, sexuality awareness. And I try and build that in as I'm going through and doing my physical exam. I'm talking to them, I'm chatting with them about a lot of the important issues that they talk about. And I especially focus if somebody identifies that perhaps they are, you know, they identify as gay, they identify as, you know, they're not quite sure if they really fit in the right body, then that is somebody that, you know, I will always run late for that patient, right? So I will really expand that visit and just really, really focus on this being a safe space for them to come.
I really liked the point that you brought up about, you know, we do the physical exam and it takes us, you know, 5 to 10 minutes to do that physical exam, that it really can be an opportunity to kind of expand the education that and answer questions that our patients may have while we're actually, you know, focused on, you know, looking in their ears and looking in their mouth and, you know, checking their back and doing all those other things. That it does provide additional time within that visit to kind of get at some other questions that you may not have gotten to in the HEDS assessment or, you know, whatever parts of the visit that you're doing.
So yeah, using the physical exam as a jumping off point is a wonderful way to engage in those conversations because you're already kind of in an intimate space. And I think about the exam room as very much like a ritualistic space, as this is a place where, you know, I am serving the patient, right? I am here for them and this is a safe space. And I'm very, very particular about that a bit, that really having this ritual and this being a privileged space and sharing that idea with the patients. I think that generally tends to communicate my kind of goals with them pretty well.
Right. And not being distracted and being kind of in the moment and listening.
Right.
Those are all really important points.
Yeah. That's not a moment where I'm turning to my computer screen. That's the computer screen's turned away, right? We're now in this. Yeah.
That's great. What kinds of questions do you think you encounter most frequently with male patients about safer sex, contraception, condoms, any of the things that we've talked about today?
So, you know, when we think about contraception for males, we're really stuck in the condom box. Now, I'm going to give them condoms. I am going to tell them to go and have some fun with it, play around, put it on, see how it works, right? Go through all that kind of experimentation. So there's sort of a limited bandwidth there from the patient standpoint of like, what else are we going to talk about?
Mm-hmm.
Well, something I'm starting to focus on now is PrEP and PEP. So thinking about, 20% of new HIV cases are in those who are 25 years or under, which is squarely in the teenage population. And yes, the risk is higher in those males who are having sex with other males, but the risk exists regardless. And so I'm starting now to shift my focus on looking at PrEP and PEP.
I just wanted to clarify too for our audience who's listening, who may not be familiar with PEP or PrEP. So that's the PrEP is the pre-exposure prophylaxis medication to prevent HIV. And then post-exposure prophylaxis is after there's been potentially an exposure to prevent infection.
And that's something that, I am starting to focus on males mostly, but I think it's important to focus on females as well, especially given some of the relationship dynamics that can happen in the teenage years. But yeah, so that's sort of where I'm, and it's a really interesting one that, I really don't get that many questions from teen males.
I also wanted to just go back to, I was just reflecting on your conversation about consent and having these conversations with teenagers, but, this very much also plays into contraception, right? And consent and making sure that teenagers are having conversations with their partners about expectations for condom use and contraception use both ways, right? So do you have any comments on that or thoughts?
I mean, it's all part of the discussion, right? It's, I will often challenge my teen patients, what is consent? Tell me, define it for me. And then there's often the umming and the ahhing. And so that allows me that opportunity to say, well, here is what consent is. Mm-hmm. And that I think is sort of, strange. Teenagers are such a strange sort of group to take care of, because they can be so obtuse in many ways, right? They don't want to talk about these things, and you're like, are you really listening to me? And then they'll say something at a future visit and you'll go, oh, you actually were listening to me. Okay, right. Which makes it fun, but it also, it makes those conversations very one-sided a lot of the time.
So I have one other question. Do you have any advice for providers? I sometimes hear that male providers are a little reluctant to have contraceptive conversations with their female adolescent patients. I'm not generalizing in any way, but just for those that may be a concern for them, do you have any tips for them?
I think going back to when we started the conversation of just being frank, don't be somebody that you're not, right? Have a conversation with the teenager as a human being, as somebody who, is, I often joke, you couldn't pay me any amount of money to go back and become and be a teenager again. Just couldn't, no way, no thank you, right?
Me either.
What a traumatic period of life where you are navigating, you're maybe an adult, you're not an adult, you're kind of a kid, but you're not a kid. You still like to play with some kids' toys, but you don't really. But then you also like to do adult things. It's such a confusing time. And that poor frontal lobe is just not there yet, It's not able to make good decisions. So I think being open, being frank, being, try not to sound young, right? Try not to be like hip and cool. Like, I am who I am. I'm a middle-aged man who is here to provide you with a service, and I want to do that compassionately. I find that, a lot of the things that I do are, I try and lead with a nursing mindset, right? Try and have that lens of a nursing mindset. And I think by default, if you are looking through a nursing lens, whether you're a nurse practitioner, a doctor nursing practice, whether you're an RN or an LVN, I think if you come to that, I will be here in your darkest moment, I'll be at your bedside. I think that serves, you'll be serving adolescents really well just from that mindset. You have to have a compassionate, empathetic mindset. And so being open and being really frank, like, being a teenager is hard, and having that conversation, I think you can see the sort of the shield melt away a little bit when you just acknowledge the fact that, hey, this isn't going to last forever. This is a stage in your life. And you know, it doesn't have to be so traumatic. But I wanted to go to the emergency contraceptive, that the sort of emergency contraceptives is not something that is really talked about, at least in my clinic, to males. And it's interesting because I have read a bit of the literature about this, and it's funny because I find that emergency contraceptives, there's so many layers to this. Think about school-based clinics, for example, providing a certain emergency contraceptives. In LA, we've no problem with that. We are a private clinic running out of a school, but many school-based clinics are run through the school district budget. And if you go to somewhere like the South, or you know, I think the Northeast is also another area that has been identified, that it so many people will tie things like emergency contraceptives to abortion.
Yeah, correct.
And that it becomes this really interesting pulse on society, right? Those places that provide EC are also the places that tend to be a little bit more left-leaning. But I think also the literature is fairly clear about, well, that a lot of males don't even realize that they can go and buy it. They do, like, it's like, oh, that's, you know, and I think that that's another interesting societal kind of pulse point, where we're in this changing of the guards, where we've got this, the old guard, the old generation, are who perhaps were a little bit more conservative in their social values, to the new guard that perhaps are a little bit more liberal in their social values, that the issue of emergency contraceptives seems to highlight that too. Whereas before, family planning was all, you know, that was the woman's job, and I'm the man, and I'm going to go to work, and you're going to stay at home and raise the kids. That was very distinct. Whereas now those roles are blurring much more. That you can sort of see that, right, in the literature, whereas the rates have risen, but they're still very, very low. And sort of anecdata, you know, if I think about my peer group, right, middle-aged men who are not medical professionals, they don't even know what the difference between emergency contraceptive and contraceptives is, right?
Right.
Or are. Like they don't. I'm going to talk about long-acting, you know, reversible contraceptives, and I'm going to talk about EC in the same sentence, and there's not really a distinction. And so I think a lot of times we need to focus on the way in which the male adolescent can really be empowered by some of these methods that we have, even though it's not going to be necessarily affecting their body.
Well, they can be supportive of their partner. Right. They can be a source of information, right? I always believe that, you know, the more people that know about contraception or emergency contraception or how to use condoms correctly, they can help each other out, right? So if you have a best friend or a partner that may not, you know, be as knowledgeable about any of those things, that it's a conversation they can have. It's a conversation starter. It's great.
Yeah.
That can parlay into expectations. Like, I'm expecting that you're going to use the condom the entire time, or, you know, right, I have condoms, so you didn't get to go get them. I have them. And that's okay. And this is what I'm expecting. I mean, I think those are all really important conversations. It kind of speaks to, I mean, it would be lovely if we had longer visits where we could really role play, you know, these conversations more actively with patients. Because if, you know, I think it's probably unfortunate, but I don't know where else they're having these conversations.
Well, I think a lot of teenagers are having those conversations within themselves, right? And the problem, you know, one of the problems is a lot of those messages are coming from social media, and those messages are not necessarily correct, right? The distortion that you'll see on social media is really, really a problem when it comes to teenagers understanding what is what is real, what is not real. And so I kind of think about it from that perspective as well, of saying that, you know, look, here is the fact. And providing them with, like, I often provide, like, Planned Parenthood resources, for example. Like, I'll pull up the website. Here are all the different contraceptive methods that you and your partner could have together or could choose. And this is where you need to go. Like, something like scarlatine.com, for example, I think is another great resource for patients to go to and kind of have real answers. So even in the visit, if we can't role play and we can't have those discussions, what can we do? What seeds can we plant in the visit that allow them to go and explore And because they have questions, right? They may just not know what those questions are. And so they can go and answer ask those questions privately. They don't have to, you know, have another person there. But then those conversations are going to be happening within their peer groups. And so if I can plant a seed of like truth in a teenager, I sort of hope that that's going to, pardon the pun, disseminate to their friends in a meaningful way. And that's kind of an exciting outcome, I think.
Right. Or even just to refute bad evidence, right? Like that's not what Chris said. That's not what my provider said. I asked this question and I believe them, right? So it gives them some power to question what they're hearing and not just accept it at face value, but to kind of have that right information to inform the decision-making.
Yeah. I think it's also difficult I think it's also difficult to know where we stand on that, because I think that clinicians don't always have the confidence to speak to teenagers. Mm-hmm. And I think the lack of confidence amongst teenagers, we're not necessarily sharing those messages. But then also there's really a lack of study about, you know, emergency contraception or contraception and perceptions of those, so that qualitative evaluation on males specifically, right? The literature is just not really where it needs to be. And so I think when you've got a sort of this lack of study, but also a lack of provider confidence, they sort of feed into themselves. Because there's a lack of confidence and there's not the bandwidth in the day-to-day, it's not getting studied. And because it's not studied, the providers don't have a sense of confidence because they don't have any data to go on, or they don't understand what the trends are within male perception.
Or even
so it's just a fascinating space.
Or even in the value of including, you know, more conversation about it, because, you know, no one's saying I have to do it. You know, no one's saying that it works. No one's saying that it makes impact, you know, an impact. And if I have to use, you know, my next 5 minutes carefully, how am I going to use those? That's a really important point. So if you could share from today's conversation one key takeaway for clinicians that may be listening to this podcast, what would you hope that they take away from this conversation?
You're not always going to be able to practice adolescent medicine as you would like to practice adolescent medicine. But I think if you advocate for teenagers, you know, really authentically, within the bandwidth that you have in your day-to-day practice, you're going to be winning. Even if it's just put up a poster, you know, have your paper bags ready to go, right? With your condoms, you know, whatever other literature you want to put in there. Do the things that you can do in the time that you have, and understand that if you just do that, you're going to be just a bit better.
And you're going to be making things better in general, right? You're going to be making a positive change, and, you know, one patient at a time. And, you know, over the course of time, I think it does make an impact. It does change things for the better for teenagers.
I would say be a clinical champion as well. So being director of clinical operations, I am now scouting for clinical champions, right? I was a clinical champion myself. And you know, I think that if you find people who have an interest in teen care, give them some meat behind their desire, right? So that really say empower that individual and make your voice heard as well, so that people know that you're interested in teen care and that you can maybe take a lead and, you know, start to organize some of the resources that might be necessary. So it'd be a clinical champion for sure.
That's a great point. Do you have any single clinical pearl that you'd like to share about providing contraceptive access to teenage males?
I think it counts for females and for males. I think the question that I have had more than any other question about contraception is, what's the best contraceptive method?
Interesting.
Right? Which one's the best one? Like, well, which one can you take?
Exactly.
Which one can you reliably take? Like, if you want, you know, OCPs, great. Do you feel like you can take those every single day? I am all for it. If you don't, you know. So, yeah, the best method is the method that you can take. That's I think, a really good clinical pearl for adolescents.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've really enjoyed our conversation on behalf of myself, but also those adolescents that you're really positively impacting.
Thanks for the opportunity. I enjoyed talking about it, and would love to have more conversations in the future.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of Protected, Adolescence and Contraception, a Teen Peds Talks podcast series brought to you by the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners. Join us again next time for another conversation about this important topic.